Welcome to Vital Voices. Have you ever wondered how a kidney transplant is done? Today, you'll find out. Our guest is Dr. Douglas Hale, a transplant surgeon at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Last year, the Vanderbilt Transplant Center performed 960 solid organ transplants, the most ever completed by a single center in 1 year in the United States. It's now the nation's largest transplant center by volume. In the adult transplant program, surgeons at Vanderbilt performed 368 kidney transplants last year. March is Kidney Month, and among those Vanderbilt surgeons is Dr. Douglas Hale, our guest today. I began our discussion by asking Dr. Hale to describe for me how the kidney transplant process gets started and how it progresses.
We'll get notified that we have an individual who is number two on the list or number four on the list or whatever. The OPO will post the donor information on a website that we access, and we can look at all the different variables that go into determining whether or not the organ is suitable for use. And then we'll make a decision whether it's worthwhile pursuing. That's when the coordinators will typically call, you know, the patient and say, "Hi, how are you? You're doing fine. Have you been in the hospital? Have you been sick recently? Is everything okay? Because there's an organ out there and it's possibly going to be heading in your direction." Then it typically will take, you know, maybe another half a day or so before the smoke clears and all of the institutions that are being offered the organs, you know, some of them will turn them down, some of them will accept them. And so it takes, you know, maybe about 10, 12 hours or so before the list matures and you know who's really going to be number one for the organ, who's going to be really number two. So you may start off at number 12, but if the 11 people ahead of you can't get a transplant for a variety of reasons, you'll wind up being eventually number one. And then usually about that time that everything's maturing is the same time that they're figuring out when that patient is going to be going to the OR for the procurement. Typically what happens is the institution that is going to receive the liver sends the procuring surgeons, and so they will procure the liver, the kidneys, and the pancreas if they're present. And so once we know when the OR time is, we'll have a general idea of when the organ is going to get here because we can just plot out, you know, distance and stuff. We figure out how far away the patient lives and how soon, you know, we'll have a cross match. And that's when we figure out when to have the patient come in so that they're here and ready to go by the time that the organ gets here is ready to go so we can go to the OR. That's the flow. And it happens many times a week. So what will happen is the kidneys are removed, they're flushed on the back table, and then they are, depending upon the age of the donor, they are also biopsied and they are looked at under a microscope. And so then we'll get a final piece of information that says this is what the anatomy of the kidneys are, this is how many veins, how many arteries, this is what they look like, and then we will get also the biopsy results, and that's when we make the final acceptance of the organ. We'll say we'll take it. So then the OPO that up to that point in time was in charge of taking care of the donor and getting to the OR and getting your figure. Now they are the people who are in charge of getting the kidney from one place to the other. So they will arrange transportation either by commercial jet or courier, depending upon how far away it is. And we'll be told when the organ is going to arrive here. Knowing that information, we typically work to have the recipient here before the kidney is going to arrive, usually by several hours, so that we can do all the testing and make sure that they're ready to go. They don't need to have dialysis done or something like that. And then then probably the easiest part of the whole process happens, that's the surgery. So we tell the operating room, you know, we'll have an organ and we'll have a recipient at this point. And this is the time we we would like to go. And we usually go within a few hours of that time. They're usually pretty accommodating for it. Kidney transplant takes about 3 hours, something like that. You know, maybe a couple hours in the recovery room after that. 3 days in the hospital and then out.
What are the technical challenges of this surgery in terms of the dexterity that you have to develop as a surgeon?
You know, I don't think there's anything more technically demanding for kidney transplant than it is for like most other forms of surgery. The most technically challenging aspects of transplant surgery have to do with the nature of the tissue you're working with. And so for an average run-of-the-mill first-time transplant where you're going into tissue that hasn't been manipulated before, and where there's good anatomy, it's a relatively straightforward and simple operation to do. You know, we sew a vein together with a vein, an artery with an artery, and then the ureter directly to the bladder. And these are all relatively standardized. We don't do it that much differently than the way it was done back in the 1950s, honestly. Where the real challenge comes in is when you are putting the transplant into somebody who's had three prior transplants and everything is scar, or somebody who has very limited blood vessel availability and there's a lot of calcium in their blood vessels. So those are the technically challenging operations, and we try to mitigate the challenge by being very thorough in their evaluation beforehand so that we know when we open up that there's only a very short segment of vessel available for use, that we're opening up in such a way that that segment is available to us and we're not going in finding out that nothing's usable and then we have to go over to the other side and look over there. And so that's really the hardest thing about it, is just dealing with reoperative surgeries.
How do you sew vein to vein? What do you use and how is that done?
It's called an end-to-side technique is typically what we use. The kidney comes with a vein hanging off of it.
Mm-hmm.
We take the end of that vein, you have a vein in your body that runs in the pelvis. We control it with clamps above and below, and we make a little slit in the vein. And then we take the end of that other vein, put it down there, and then sew them together. We use a suture it's 6-0 proline, which is a standard vascular suture. It's about the size of a hair in terms of its size. You know, but the connection itself is maybe a good inch, typically, of the vein. The artery is usually much smaller. You know, that's about maybe a third of an inch or something like that in terms of its size.
What are the factors that govern the placement of the kidney in the body?
We place it anywhere on either the external iliacs, which is down in the pelvis, the common iliacs, which is a little higher in the pelvis, or especially in small children, we'll put it directly on the aorta and the vena cava, which is directly in the abdomen. But the vast majority of cases, it goes pretty deep in the pelvis, right next to the bladder. It makes it nice and easy to connect it.
You're listening to Vital Voices, a production of WETS-FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our guest is Dr. Douglas Hale, a transplant surgeon at Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Let's talk about you for a little bit, if we could. What led to your decision to become a transplant surgeon?
Yeah, I wasn't planning to be a transplant surgeon when I first started my surgical training. I was planning to go and do cardiothoracic. And the training is 5 years long for general surgery. And then after that, you do an extra 2 or 3 years of training in the subspecialties. At least that's the way it was done back then. So my plan was to do heart surgery, and then at the beginning of my fourth year of training, I did 6 months of research. And during that 6 months of research, I did a bunch of transplants in monkeys. And that's what got me hooked. You know, seeing organs gray, lifeless, cold, and plugging them in and watching them come back to life. There was nothing like it. So, yeah. So that's what led to this. Yeah. And so then you go, and I went into transplant training. And when you do it, abdominal transplant, you train. I did kidney, liver, and pancreas. Just by virtue of the jobs you choose, that tends to shoehorn you into one area or the other. And it just turns out over the course of my post-training that the programs I wound up in were focusing mainly on kidney and pancreas. So that's why I do that. I did medical school at Georgetown. That was kind of a highlight to me because it was the first time I was away from home. And I was in Washington, D.C., and I was a fish out of water. So that was fascinating. It was just fascinating living in Washington, D.C. So I want to say, a good four-fifths of my class were folks who were heading ultimately into the military. I applied for training in the Army. I did my first year of training in El Paso. Then went to the Middle East for a year and then came back to Walter Reed and finished my training there. Knew I wanted to do transplant at that point in time. However, the Army also knew that it didn't want me to do transplant at that point in time. So I spent 5 years as a general surgeon. And during the last 2 years of working as a general surgeon, I arranged for a civilian fellowship once I got out of the military. And so that's when I went to Boston, did that. And then very ironically wound up coming back to NIH, where we were doing a lot of experimentation in immunosuppression. But part of that job was also doing the transplants at Walter Reed, which I had left just before to go to fellowship. And so I wound up back in the same place I started anyhow. Loved my time there.
Why is Vanderbilt the right place for you?
I think it's a good mix of patient care. So there's lots of patients to take care of, lots of transplants to do. And so I like doing that. I like taking care of patients. I like teaching residents. And so there's a lot of that that goes on here. I especially like with my history, I like working at the VA. That's a big component of my job here. And I like trying to make it easier for those guys to get transplants because it hasn't always been the case. And so we're making some inroads to making it easier for them to get transplanted. And so that's very rewarding for me. And I'm quite content to do this until I hang it up.
You told me you did not grow up with a privileged background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Buffalo. My parents are still there. And, my dad was a mechanic. And so, I mean, my hobby now is cars, working on cars.
Really?
Yeah. And, but I mean, growing up as a kid, we always, the neighbors brought their cars to our house and my father fixed them. And then when we got old enough, we wouldn't kill ourselves. He had us helping him do it and then just kind of stuck.
Any common connections between working on cars and working on bodies?
100%. It is. I get the same satisfaction of sitting over an engine and systematically taking it apart and putting it back together that you get in the operating room. There was 100% crossover of that.
I can't let you leave without asking you to talk about the value and the importance of organ donation.
There's a massive need for organs, right? And so the problem is, how do you convince people to overcome personal biases, cultural biases, and how do you convince them to do that at a time of immense grief, to agree to organ donation? I mean, this is the problem that the country has been dealing with for the last 20 years, and that still a lot of organs wind up getting buried that could have been used. And so how do you fix that? I think you make people more aware of the need. I think you really work hard to make sure that the system for allocating organs is transparent and fair, because the minute people think that something is rigged in somebody else's favor, then they're going to lose interest in donating. And you have to publicize the success stories to show people what a difference it does make. You know, it's a lot easier, I think, to take, you know, a small child with a liver or heart transplant and to show the transformation in them and the future that they have. But, you know, the same benefit is conferred to everyone, no matter what they get, either a cornea, a kidney, or a pancreas. I mean, it is a life transforming event. And, you know, I'm not exactly sure how, you know, other than through the standard mechanisms of, you know, advertising, public service announcements, getting celebrities to take up the cause, all the usual ways of trying to raise awareness of the need and making people aware of the benefits and the fact that they are equitably distributed. I think that's the way you'll maximize, you know, the utilization. And until the time comes where we can grow these either in a barnyard or in a test tube, this is going to be the limiting factor.
Tell me about the satisfaction and the rewards you get from being a transplant surgeon.
I mean, it's a great feeling to take care of folks and to have them do well. It's frustrating when they don't do well. And under those circumstances, you know, our solace is we tried as hard as we could to get them a good outcome. And just sometimes it's out of our hands. But thank goodness the good outcomes far outnumber, you know, the bad.
Currently in the United States, around 106,000 people are on the national transplant waiting list for a kidney. But only about 17,000 receive one each year. On average, 11 to 13 people in the United States die every day while waiting for a new kidney. Our guest on Vital Voices has been Dr. Douglas Hale, a transplant surgeon at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, one of the leading transplant centers in the world. For Vital Voices, I'm Fred Sossman.